Okay, because Giselle's away and stuff like that, you can intro the song. We're not going to play it until we'll add it in. Just say, hi, we're going to whatever, and then give yourself 5-7 seconds, and then just come back like the song played, and Casey will throw it in after. And besides that, I'm going to start the music in about 10 seconds, okay?
Okay, I'm just going to start out with Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour then.
No. I'm going to play the music now to start the show. I'm saying okay. When the two songs you sent me, when you throw to them, just remember we can't play because no one's here. It's only me. So right. just say, hey, I forgot the name of the song, unfortunately. But, okay, we're going to the Jason song. And then give yourself 5 seconds. You know. Okay, thank you. Hold on. Okay. I'll start the show. Hold on.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, November 16th. Wow, November 16th. Don't look now, but November is half over, and we have only 7 more weeks in this year. I don't have to tell most of you that we've been having some technical difficulties on Sunday nights here at PRN, but as I've mentioned in the past, if you're unable to access the show for any reason, check the archives an hour or so later and you should be able to access the show there. We continue to have some fabulous guests lined up for you, and next week we're going to have Mimi Gurman back again with us, not to talk about Fukushima and all things nuclear, but to share a recent experience that she had that's directly aligned with what this show is all about. Namely, the time that she spent with Brittany Maynard, who chose to end her life last week. As you know, Brittany is the woman who made national and international news by choosing to end her life in Oregon peacefully in the face of terminal brain cancer, which was certain to be a horrific death for her. So I know you're going to want to be here and listen to Mimi talk about this. She remains a mainstay of the Lifeboat Hour, and it's always a treat to have her with us. I also want to thank all of you who joined us this past Thursday night for the webinar when my guest was Guy McPherson. The webinar will continue every Thursday night through December 18th, skipping Thanksgiving. We had a wonderful, wonderful webinar this week with lots of participation and lots of comments and questions for Guy. And as always, his comments, his direction to us was fantastic. What a unique opportunity this webinar is to imbibe the knowledge that our fabulous guest speakers have for us and ask them questions and make comments. So if you haven't yet registered for the webinar, please go to SYNCCAST, that's SYNCHCAST.net, in order to find out more about the webinar and register there. We're now offering single sessions for the webinar, so if you aren't able to attend the entire webinar, you have that option. With your registration, you receive not only access to future webinar sessions, but access to past recordings as well. And while we're on the topic of Guy McPherson, I'm going to be on his radio show, Nature Bats Last, this Tuesday night, November 18th, right here on PRN at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I hope you'll join us. Hey, and still on the topic of Guy, we have with us tonight a person who's been working very closely with him for more than a year, documenting his life and work. That person is Pauline Schneider, whose work on the documentary about Guy called Going Dark, named after Guy's book, Going Dark, has created a monumental piece of history, an invaluable record for what posterity there is down the road will have. And she is really helping us look at Guy, what he's done, who he is, and what he is asking the world to look at. Pauline Schneider is a Greek-American born in Nigeria and raised in Athens, Greece. As a child, she witnessed the beginnings of the Biafra War in Nigeria when a band of men came to her home with torches to extort money from her mother. And then later in Greece, she saw the coup led by the CIA that installed a military junta in place of a democratically elected leadership. She holds degrees in radio and TV production, anthropology and sociology, and a master's in social studies education with an emphasis on special education. She's also a New York Botanical Gardens certified landscape designer and has been gardening since the age of 13. Pauline recently completed the documentary Going Dark, and we're very eager to talk with her more about the process of making the documentary Going Dark. Her two children live in Brooklyn, and her one teenager lives at home with Pauline, along with a menagerie of furry and feathered siblings. Pauline Schneider, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Hi, Carolyn. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's such a pleasure. So, Pauline, I'd really like you to summarize for us your own process of waking up to the state of the world. How did it happen? And what was the sort of scaffolding necessary to make it happen and allow you to hear Guy's message and not turn away? I'm guessing the most difficult part was really grasping the reality of near-term human extinction.
Yes. Carolyn, grasping the reality of that has been a real journey in and of itself. And, I like the term scaffolding. It's a term we use in education because you can't just introduce an idea to somebody when they don't have the foundation to understand it. You wouldn't teach a child about, algebra if they can't add or subtract.
Right.
Initially. So you have to build their understanding. And it's very similar with trying to grasp these big ideas of human extinction, what that means. I was brought up, in a household. I'm Greek American, as you mentioned. I was raised around stories of, slavery and war and torture. And so these things have always been with me. My father lived under Nazi occupation. My grandfather fought the Ottomans. I was reminded today, I was talking online with Gail Zawacki, who you've had on the show before. And a few months ago, I had told her a story, when we're children in Greece, we celebrate and we reenact this incredible time during the Turkish invasion, where in this one particular mountain village, the women chose to dance with their children off of a cliff. They chose suicide as opposed to a life of torture and servitude and slavery and abuse. So these are things, these are my scaffolding, my whole life, you can say, what a horrible thing to have brought a child up with, but that's the world that I lived in, and I saw, living in Nigeria, humans are fragile, and, we break very easily if we don't respect that fragility, and I think that it's important for us to recognize that, and also to recognize scaffolding is important to bring the idea of near-term human extinction to other people. Some people just aren't ready for it, and we have to be gentle with them and allow them that space and let them come when they're ready. You can't force things on people if they're not ready. They will blank out. They will not just move away from you. They could become, actually violently resistant. And you see that. You can see that, in Facebook groups when people just they're not ready for it.
Well, I see that all the time with coaching clients who come to me, and want to know how do I explain all this stuff to my family? They don't want to hear about it. And, I tell them similarly to what you're telling me that, sometimes people really have to be ready. There has to be that kind of scaffolding there. You have to go very gently with them. And some people are never going to be ready. And then we have to deal with the feelings around that and the loss that we feel around, gosh, I can't share this deep level of intimacy with these people I care about.
Yeah. And that's a heartache.
It absolutely is, and it's particularly difficult, I think, for people who have children. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, people with children often have a much more difficult time accepting the reality of near-term human extinction than people that don't. So as a mother, what has it been like for you to wake up?
I cry a lot when I wake up.
Yeah.
You know, I wake up in the middle of the night and I lie there and I'm thinking, my kids don't have a future. They have a little one right now. And so that's the one I focus on. And that's the one they want to focus on. They want me to focus on what they have and pretend that there is a future. And they don't want to talk about near-term human extinction. You know, they're not, it's so debilitating for them to even entertain that idea. In fact, my youngest child, who's been suffering from depression for a while and is unrelated to near-term human extinction, actually has a sort of a kind of restraining order on me through her therapist. I'm not allowed to talk about it. And if I even say climate change or global warming or anything, she goes, Mom, do I need to have a talk with my therapist?
Right. Yeah, I just think it's very difficult for people that young. Because, I mean, developmentally speaking, we have that sense of our entire lives in front of us. And how can we possibly listen to someone who tells us that maybe we only have 10 or 20 years left?
Well, it's true. I mean, but we're all going to die anyway. I mean, that's the ultimate truth that we don't like to acknowledge. That's the big denial that we live in every day, even if we don't acknowledge near-term human extinction. I mean, ultimately, we each go into our own extinction. The difference is we leave legacies behind. We leave stories. We leave photos. We leave art. We leave something. We feel like, you know, someone will tell our story at some point in the future. I mean, you know, I've walked the stones of the Acropolis. And I don't know the people who built it. I don't know their names, but I feel their presence when I step on those thousands of years old marble. And there's something very comforting. It's like, you know, you feel like there's a continuation. And this NTHE is a door that closes on that. And there will not be a continuation. There will not be legends told of our heroic struggle to survive or to teach or to engage. And, you know, and that's, to me, you know, looking the abyss right in the face and just seeing that is pretty devastating. And I don't think a lot of people can do that. It's very difficult to do.
I agree. Because the notion that we don't, that there won't be people to look at those photos or read what we wrote, and that it all ends with us, is not only about physical death, but it's about a kind of soul death or spiritual death. To not have a legacy appreciated. You know, you could leave a legacy, but who knows if it will ever be picked up and seen.
Right. Right, exactly. And the thing that gave me comfort as I struggled with these ideas was the idea that we did come from the universe. We are made of stardust. We have the dust of the moon in our bones. the dust of stars. And we will go back to that, and something else will happen with our dust in the future. There is a egotism that we have as humans. You know, we do feel like we've reached this ultimate evolution. As humans, we can express ourselves, and we can share our emotions and our ideas, and we can invent things and create things. But ultimately, we are stardust, and that's so much bigger than inventing a really cool camera or a computer. And people don't, I don't know if a lot of people realize that, but that, to me, that's what brought me comfort, that I will always be stardust. I always have been stardust, and that helps.
Well, you know, as you say that, I just have to put in one more commercial here for the webinar, because our next to last speaker in the webinar series is Ann Amberg, and she's going to talk about what the universe does and how it does it through us. And that whole I'm stardust conversation is going to be very, very relevant. And I think she's going to leave us with a tremendous amount of inspiration, even in the face of NTHE.
That's great.
So one of the most common issues that I see when I'm working with people who seek me out for life coaching is what happens for them when they do wake up to this information in terms of the way it affects their relationships. And you've talked a little bit about how this has played out for you in terms of your kids. But will you share some of your own experiences if you have any suggestions for people who are dealing with this, please share those.
Well, I think, you know, we're a very small group of people who can grasp this, or who are willing to try to grasp this idea of NTHE. And we are few and far between. And as much as the virtual world of social, you know, interaction is imperfect, right now it is ideal for us to reach out to each other and find each other. And that there are several groups, you know, on Facebook that have created, you know, a space for us to talk and to share, because many of us don't have those intimate relationships where we can talk about it and wrestle with those things. And it scares our partners away. Or, you know, as in my situation, my kids just don't want to hear about it, or I'm forbidden from talking about it. So it's good to find those people, even if they are far away from you, and share that, you know, that time with them. We're wrestling with these big ideas, and they're scary, and they're sad, and they're not always easy. And often we can get caught up in the minutiae of, you know, of what this is. But the big picture is what's really important, and that is let's hold each other and help each other and be compassionate and empathetic, because we're all not at the same point. And we waffle. We go back and forth. Robin Westenra said something really smart the other day about it's accepting NTHE is not a point of acceptance. And that's very true. You go in and out of this acceptance. And I had that happen to me the other day. I'm standing in my kitchen in my little house that I've worked so hard to create. And then in the last year, everything has changed. And it's just really, really heartbreaking to look at my house and see that it means really nothing and that it's all going away. And for a moment, I just closed my eyes and I went back to the weeks before I heard Guy McPherson's lecture at Mount Kisco Library, where I believed that, you know, we would have this warming and there would be some climate change, but that we would, you know, if we were smart and we could take care of each other, we would be okay. We could ride this out. And I wouldn't have to, you know, go through this grief process or grief recovery or, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what conversation to have with what person. Is this okay? Is this safe? Am I treading on dangerous territory with them? where everything would be fine. And I can keep driving my car and not worrying about and travel and do things. And for a moment, I was okay. I was like back in that world. And then I returned. And, you know, everybody needs a little vacation.
Absolutely. I totally believe that we need some distractions here and there. And distracting ourselves does not mean we're going back into denial. It just means that we kind of regroup so that we can keep going.
Yeah.
And you did mention the couple of Facebook groups. Could you just spell those out for us? I believe it's Near-Term Human Extinction is one of the support groups. And then there's another one, Near-Term Human Extinction Love.
Correct.
And are there others?
There are several. If you go to those two, you'll find links to other groups and can ask the people in those groups. In New York City, David Petratis has started a near-term human extinction group to actually meet physically with people, which is wonderful. Mm. And he's in those Facebook groups as well. I don't have his email right here off the top of my head. But it's, you know, there are people out there and they're looking for people to connect with both virtually and in person. And I think they're both important. And if you can't find somebody in person to talk to and cry with and hug, then definitely go the virtual route, because we do give a lot of virtual hugs. There were several virtual hugs the other day in the love group, so it's really important that we do that.
Yeah, and I just want to mention that 5 years ago, I started a group here in Boulder, which at that time was just kind of focused on collapse. And we've continued for about 5 years. And then after Guy was here last fall, we got a number of people as a result of his being here. So we are kind of continuing to hammer out who we really are and what our intention is. But most of the people in the group are very much on board with NTHE, and it's very much in the consciousness of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you said on a couple occasions that accepting NTHE helps trim the fat from one's life and detoxify it. What do you mean by that, and how did that happen for you?
Well, when you realize that your life, I mean, our lives are already brief, but when you realize the ultimateness of that, you don't necessarily want to waste your time on toxic relationships.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's made me very stingy with my time and space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to entertain those toxic relationships that I might have in the past, which is interesting because it's made me both more patient with some people and less patient with others. So sometimes I can get pretty snippy at people because I just don't feel like I don't have the time to expend in dealing with a toxic person, and I don't want to do that.
Do you have folks around you physically that you can talk about these things with, or is everything online?
Yes, I do have a friend. I have a couple of friends that I can talk to about it, so that really helps.
Good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's true for a lot of people. You know, we realize how valuable people are that are in our lives, the ones that are not toxic. And you want to spend more time with those people, your children, your friends, your parents, your cousins, the good friends that fulfill you. And I know that sounds very selfish and egotistical, but life is short. And I, you know, in the last couple of years, I've lost friends to stupid things. Like a friend went to cross the street to go meet her husband at a restaurant. She was hit by a car, gone in a blink.
Mm. Wow.
Another friend died of cancer after years of struggling. I have another friend who's going away very soon because of cancer. It's, you know, those are precious relationships. You want to nurture those and you want to spend time with them. You don't want to spend time with the toxic ones that,
right,
you know, the takers and the haters.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, one of the things that I know you find especially supportive and restorative is art and music. I am constantly talking about this in my work, how important art, music, poetry, dance, drama, all of this is for us. And you've written a song with lyrics from a poem by Guy McPherson. The song is called Doing You Wrong, A Song for Mother Earth. Tell us about that song before we listen to it.
Well, he had written this poem, this beautiful poem, and he shared it on his website, and I just felt moved to songify it, and it happened very naturally. I just said, oh, I think that would work really well as a song. So I left out some lyrics, changed some around, and as a, you know, songwriter, I had to do it. And I'm not the best singer out there or songwriter, but it's something that I started doing when I was 14 and my parents decided that we were going to leave Greece and move to Texas and plunged into a deep depression of which only playing my guitar and writing songs was able to help me get out of. So that's where this song came from, and it was a lot of fun to do. And it's on SoundCloud.
So let's listen to you singing Doing You Wrong.
It's ripping my heart out thinking of you, wondering how you grew so strong. I'm tearing your heart out, thinking of me, living so thoughtlessly, doing you wrong, doing you wrong, doing you wrong, doing you wrong. Can't run.
That was Doing You Wrong, a song for Mother Earth, written by my guest, Pauline Schneider. And this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. So, Pauline, when we really grasp what near-term human extinction means, when we really wrap our minds around it, it's incredibly painful because it's really the same as getting a terminal diagnosis. For you, what has been the most painful part?
Well, you know, my children not having a future. And, you know, I always pictured, grandchildren. I know that sounds very selfish. But, you know, that's my pain. That's my heartache. I have another one. I think of dragonflies and other creatures, but dragonflies have been here 300 million years. You know, we've only been here a couple million. Yeah, dragonflies. 300 million years they've been evolving. And we're going to wipe them out along with ourselves. So you think of butterflies and dragonflies and all those wonderful creatures around us who have more of a right to stay here than we do. And that's a tremendous grief that I feel in my heart. It just... I am actually getting choked up right now, but...
Yeah.
That's hard.
This is really hard stuff.
And look at that and see the world that's going away.
Yeah, it really, really is painful. And there was a story in The Guardian this week. The headline was something like, we're wiping out species so fast that we could throw the Earth into like a very acute tipping point that would be acutely catastrophic. And, you know, if we think of near-term human extinction, this would be even nearer in a sense. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of jaw-dropping to even see that headline.
And when did that come out?
that was sometime earlier this week. It was in The Guardian. Uh-huh. I should have snagged that story and documentation for it, but I didn't. I can actually send that to you. And what I'll do is I'll post it on my Facebook page. Mm-hmm. And I'll paste it on the NTHE group page so that, you know, people will make sure that they see it.
Sure, that's good. And yeah. These are things we've known about for decades. And scientists have been warning for decades that this could happen. And it's just so shocking to me that all of a sudden people make it sound like this is new information.
Right.
It's not new. I remember as a child, I was reading the National Geographic as a child, and the warnings were in there. It's not a new thing.
Well, you know, when I was on pre-recording yesterday for Guy's radio show, we talked about stories and narratives. And, you know, I talked about how I tell stories with the African drum, and usually the stories I tell are from Greek mythology or they're from indigenous traditions. And this is a theme in indigenous traditions, extinction, because so many of them have experienced it. And it was kind of an ongoing fear or something they had to live with for many of these tribes. And then eventually for thousands of them, they're just not here anymore.
Right.
So it's not a new idea.
No, it's absolutely not. I mean, it's so not a new idea that I think in Guy's book, Going Dark, at the opening, he has that opening saying by Lao Tzu. Where is it? If I can find it. I have such a bad memory from... Oh, here it is. Yeah, Lao Tzu. I'm going to read that to you.
Please.
When man interferes with the Tao, the sky becomes filthy. The earth becomes depleted. The equilibrium crumbles. Creatures become extinct. And that's circa 550 BCE, before current era.
Right, Right.
It's not a new idea.
Well, you just mentioned the book Going Dark. So, of course, I'm very curious about making the documentary Going Dark. And I'd love it if you tell us the who, what, when, why, and how of it.
I'd love to tell you about that.
Okay, go for it.
It's going to be a documentary in the making of the documentary.
Right.
Well, you know, I have to thank you, Carolyn, because I met you at the Age of Limits conference, and I heard you speak there. And that was right on the tail of hearing, you know, Guy's story in over here in Mount Kisco next to where I live. Mm-hmm. And I think there were these seeds planted, and I was videotaping there with my phone. I was trying to grab my phone, and I had this really dumb camera, and I was just trying to tape as much as I could because I knew there was something. It was really important, and a lot of that video ended up in the documentary. But this, you planted seeds, and Guy planted seeds, and you know, and I plunged into a depression after that.
Right.
It lasted for about a month where I was just barely could get out of bed just trying to metabolize this idea and what to do with it. And as I mentioned earlier, what I do with depression is I create art out of it. I express mm-hmm. myself, my feelings. I try to share that with other people. And I felt like the message that Guy had to share was so important and so critical that I had to find a way to do that, to share that with people. I'm going to follow you for a year if that's all right with you. And he said, sure. So, you know, I went out and I bought all new equipment and started to spend all my savings on this journey. That took me all over the place, and it was not easy. You know, I'm single parenting, and I had to leave my daughter at home with friends, and that wasn't easy for her. And she really felt, you know, she felt neglected. That was a difficult time for her. But it was really, really important to do that, and I have you to thank as well, because I thought that your piece in that event was so important and so critical. It really rocked my world.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that, because some people thought it was stupid and they tried to literalize the story that I was telling instead of looking at it symbolically. And, you know, it caused a bit of an uproar. But, you know, I'm a professional troublemaker. And so on one level, that's fine with me. But it's really nice to hear that it impacted you in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a weekend of troublemaking.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, for all of us.
Yeah. Yes, we saw how the patriarchal paradigm, even amongst people who see, you know, the doom coming,
right,
is so embedded. It's very hard to get them out of that.
Yeah, that was painfully obvious. Well, you know, again, music, you just talked about your pain. And, you know, this morning I was driving down the road and listening to the classical station here in the area. And, you know, they were talking about Beethoven and how, you know, toward the end of his life, he was in Vienna, and Vienna was being attacked by Napoleon's army. And of course, he couldn't hear, but he had these vibrations of the cannons, and they were just driving him crazy. And he wrote, you know, all I can feel are these vibrations of cannons and war and conflict, and it's tearing up my soul. And he sat down and wrote the Fifth Piano Concerto, the Emperor Concerto, which is one of my favorites. And I had not heard this about this concerto before. And I'm just sobbing as I'm driving home listening to this music. And how therapeutic that must have been for him. So there's another song that you've written. It's called It's Too Late, as in the number two. Mm-hmm. And in it, you tell us it's too late to save our skin or save the earth. We're going to listen to it in a moment, but before we do, please tell us a bit more about this song.
Well, you know, coming to terms I think I keep saying that, coming to terms near-term human extinction, is also coming to terms with the idea that this machinery of industrial civilization is so big and so entrenched and so hard to shift. You know, it's like the Titanic. We were all, you know, most of us saw the film The Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know the story of the Titanic. It sank,
right,
even though it was, you know, unsinkable. But in spite of the fact that it was going to sink and people were going to die, it didn't mean that people couldn't still be kind to each other or fall in love with each other or do the right thing with each other. Obviously, some people were horrible, and that's what's going to happen anyway. But mm-hmm. we have a choice.
Yeah.
We have choices. We can choose to hold each other and love each other as we go out. And that's kind of what this song is about.
Well, let's listen to It's Too Late by Pauline Schneider.
It's too late to win this game. It's too late to save your skin. Now it's time to
beautiful song by Pauline Schneider, my guest here on the Lifeboat Hour, entitled It's Too Late.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Pauline, please tell our listeners the best way to access the documentary and the password necessary. This is a short, powerful documentary of just under a half hour, and I highly encourage people to watch and share it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Carolyn. Well, it's on my Vimeo page, and that's at my Vimeo.com/Pauline Schneider, which is spelled S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R, /Going Dark Documentary.
Now, could they just go to the Vimeo page and do a search for Going Dark?
They might be able to, but I've had a little problem with Vimeo finding even myself on there.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
What if you just straight up Googled it?
You might, yeah. You know, you can find it. And it's also, it's on Guy's webpage.
Right.
He has it listed there as well. That's easy, GuyMcPherson.com. The password to watch it is Going Dark. And the going, G is capitalized, and the D for dark is capitalized. It's case sensitive.
Is there a space in between the two words?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
And you can also get the link at my other website, which is woodthrushproductions.com. And there's a link
for it there. Woodthrushproductions.com.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So how has the documentary been received so far?
Well, one of the reasons I have it password protected still is, aside from that it's still making the film festival circuit, I didn't want it just out there because, you know, haters gotta hate.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I'm a fragile butterfly. But I wanted to share it with people who really get it and are ready to hear the message and wanted to, you know, feel like they were, you know, that they were heard. And so it's been getting great reviews.
Great.
And it's been viewed about 2,000 times, which is pretty amazing. I'm astounded by that. It's been in two film festivals, the Underfunded Film Festival mm-hmm. and the La Femme Film Festival last month in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
which is was a very fun venue. I would have loved to have gotten to get out there to go support it and, you know, get it, you know, be participant in that whole thing, but I wasn't able to go. But it was, you know, it was really, it's being really welcomed by many people who are watching it. And, you know, I just wanted to thank the people who donated music to be in the film as well. That was really, the music really added a great atmosphere to it. I just wanted to thank them all for that as well.
I wasn't aware that people had donated music. That's wonderful. I thought maybe you came up with all of that yourself, but that's great.
Well, I had some good connections, and I have had a couple of friends, and my daughter, who wrote the song and sang the song for the closing titles.
Mm-hmm.
So that was her. And that's a song she wrote when she was 18, which is, 5 years ago or something.
Wow.
Yeah. She's pretty, very talented. So it was a collaboration of sorts. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, I did the shooting and the editing and all that other good stuff. Sound. Oh my God. It was just a huge learning curve for me, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to do.
I can imagine. So I'm wondering, do you have any other video projects or any other kind of projects down the line that you are aware of at the moment?
Yeah, well, I'm still, I shot so many hours of video that ultimately what I'd like to do is to create a website where people can watch the montage section of the film and then mm-hmm. click on those different locations to see actual videos that I shot in those different locations. That's my ultimate goal. But that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I don't know when I'm going to have time for that yet. But and then Guy and I just finished writing a young people's book called Mr. Honeybee and Ms. Ladybug, A Love Story at the End of Time.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it's we wanted to create a story for children, young children, you know, from 9 and up, to help parents like us give them the scaffolding for near-term human extinction.
Right.
Speaking of the scaffolding idea earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So what it is a story of a little bee who's watched his entire hive be destroyed by, you know, collapse, hive collapse. And then a ladybug who's also on her own, and, you know, she's also seen her entire hive be destroyed, incarcerated, in fact, and treated like slaves, because you know that you can buy ladybugs to bring into your garden, and they come in little boxes, and you put them out there, and then all these ladybugs are everywhere, and then the winter comes, and where did they go? They come into your house. And then what happens? People spray them, because we don't want them in the house. We want them in the garden. So there are these interesting parallels that these little creatures are experiencing that we can anthropomorphize.
Right.
That we as humans can relate to. Oh, my God, that happened to the Native Americans. And, his entire village was destroyed. And that sort of thing. So this little couple tries to travel around together to share the message that there's, you know, we're going extinct. The world is ending. The world is coming to an end. And some of the other bugs and animals listen to them, and some of them don't. And there's a great adventure. And it's their journey, trying to find a safe place where they can go and live out the rest of the days that they may have left together.
That's wonderful. You know, I had no idea that you guys were doing that, and I think that's fabulous. Yeah, we really need something for young people.
Yeah. If you know a publisher who's interested.
Say what?
If you know a publisher who's interested, please let us know.
Yeah. Well, you say that the earth is talking to us, and we need to shut up and listen. What do you mean by that, Pauline?
Well, that's a really great question. You know, I think that there's so many people out there talking and commenting, and they tend to drown out the earth, you know, her messages to us. Her song, her rhythms, and we're not hearing her children, you know, the birds and the ocean and the rain and the wind, all these creatures, they're speaking to us every day, and it's hard for us to hear without judgment and without commentary, you know, or being called crazy that we're hearing. You're hearing things, you know, be reasonable, you know. Don't intuition, that's crazy talk.
Right.
And I think people like Mike Rupert listened to the earth, and I think a lot of people thought he might have been crazy because of that, but he was one of the listeners. And maybe we have to dance a little bit in the world of madness to be able to hear the earth. And I like to look at the people who actually did listen to what Mike Rupert had to say, and people who listened to the earth. That's people like you, Carolyn, and people like Guy, and many others who aren't afraid to hear that, to hear those messages, and to hear the truth tellers without criticizing them, embracing them in all of their humanness. With all of that, their faults and their positives, because that's who we are, we're human beings. And I think if we take that time to be silent and to just listen and sit, I think we'll be able to hear what the earth is telling us.
Well, you know, I'm very, very much on board with this. It's a huge part of my work to really help people fall in love with the earth again, or if they already have, to fall in love with the earth again on a new and deeper level. And so I do a lot of work with, you know, teaching people and helping people to explore eco-psychology and some of the great writings of eco-psychology and the work of people like Bill Plotkin and, again, Ann Amberg, who's going to be on the webinar later, in a few weeks, just to really help people have this passion for the earth, to just love it and savor it more deeply than they ever have, to touch it and feel it. And, you know, silence practices are very helpful with this, meditation practices, anything that helps us get stillness and get quiet inside. And we don't have to be outside necessarily and getting this stillness, but, you know, sometimes it's very helpful to go out there and do a stillness practice. But we can do it every day in our houses, and that really facilitates falling more deeply in love with the earth and being quiet and not being just completely engulfed by the noise and the busyness of our culture, to really find that place of stillness inside. It's inside of every person, you know, and it's very accessible if we'll just go there and tune in.
Yeah. Do you know the author John O'Donohue?
I am madly in love with John O'Donohue. Yes.
Yes. He was fantastic. And in his book Anamkara, he wrote, there's a little section where he talks about what people are, and it just blew my mind. And I just want to share that because we are not just only the earth's children. We are the earth. We are the mud, the soil that came up and sprouted legs and arms to walk around the earth, ears to hear the stories and the songs, and voices to share them, eyes to witness. I love that. And I carry that.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I carry that vision with me all the time. And he was a sage.
He was such a sage. John O'Donohue, for those who may not be familiar with him, was an Irish priest who left the priesthood. He was from the Celtic tradition, very much steeped in the Celtic tradition of Ireland, and came to this country many times, wrote some incredible books. Anamkara was the one from which Pauline was quoting, which means soul friend. He also wrote another book called Eternal Echoes, and when I pick up Eternal Echoes, I can look down and see something, and I'll be there for 2 days, you know, and then I'll read it again a week later, and I never saw that before. It's an amazing treasure trove of deep wisdom. And then my all-time favorite, I think, is his last book, Beauty, the Invisible Embrace. So anything we can read and ingest and memorize and treasure from John O'Donohue, let's do it. Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah.
We've got about 5 minutes, Pauline, or maybe just a bit less than that. Can you tell us just briefly about your experience of taking the grief recovery training and how that was helpful to you?
Oh, yes. That was amazing. That was an incredible experience. I really recommend people to take that, to learn how to be facilitators or to just go, you know, if you find a facilitator, ask them to have a workshop and create a group. What Guy and I learned there were just priceless lessons of what to do and what not to do, what to say, what not to say. And how to help people process their grief. You know, there's always all the things you don't want to say to people is the first thing people usually say. You know, I'm sure with time, you know, time heals all wounds. You'll find another, you know, I'm sure, you know, it's a good thing that, you know, you have your health and your youth, and I'm sure you'll meet another man if it's your husband who died, or if you lost a child, so you're young, you'll have more kids, or thank God you have, you know, three other children to help you. These things are not helpful when you're trying to recover from your grief, because they're saying, stop being sad. And, you know, I actually had a friend, I was talking to her a few weeks ago, and I was crying. And she said, oh, don't be sad. And I just thought, that's so insulting to my sorrow for whatever reason. I'm sad. I'm feeling a feeling. If I were laughing, would you tell me to stop laughing? No, you wouldn't.
Right.
It's part of my human experience to feel sorrow. And crying is critical for people. It sheds toxins, terrible toxins, hormonal toxins that are poisonous to our bodies. And crying releases that.
You bet.
If you, I don't know if you've ever done this experiment, but if you banged your hand or you hurt yourself and you tried not to cry, it actually hurt more.
Yeah.
But if you allowed yourself to cry, the pain actually went away.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried, I've experimented with this a few times. I didn't purposely go to hurt myself. I tend to be a klutz. So I get lots of opportunities to experiment. But these were amazing lessons. One of the exercises we did, which somebody was talking about on the Facebook Near-Term Human Extinction Love group today, this exercise was where a person in a group acts out as the deceased, and their friends surround them and tell them all the wonderful things about them and what they loved about them and what they will always remember about them. And this is a very powerful exercise, and you have to be very careful how you do it, because we had a person in one of the groups actually dissociate, and she blacked out. And didn't she, to her, you know, to us, she seemed fine. But about an hour later, in a different group doing something else, she suddenly came to and looked around and said, how did I get here? Wasn't I lying over there on the pillow? How did I, can somebody help me? I think I'm having a stroke. So you have to be very careful when you do these exercises, because grief is a powerful emotion, and we hold a lot of it inside of ourselves.
Because and with that, we need, we're just about out of time, Pauline. I do want to really validate your taking the grief recovery workshop, and I assume you're a grief counselor now.
Yeah,
and so I want to just encourage everybody to explore ways that you can work with your grief. You know, there are so many tools out there. We're going to go into this more deeply in our webinar in the next 2 weeks. It would be an excellent place to do that work. So, again, I want to thank you so much, Pauline Schneider, for all that you've done, the, making the documentary, for writing the child young person's book with Guy, and for being with us today. Thank you so much for your work, for your music. We
thank
just really
you, Carol,
appreciate you
so much. Thank you for having me on. This is really an honor.
And everyone, thank you for being with us. We'll be back again with you next week.
Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed.